Hello, and welcome back to the While We're Waiting Hope After Child Loss podcast. I'm Jill Sullivan, your host and one of the co-founders of the While We're Waiting ministry. I'm so pleased that you've joined me today to listen in to the first half of my conversation with Connor's mom, Nan Deal. Nan describes herself as a messy griever, an angry griever, and an offended griever, all things that most of us bereaved parents can certainly relate to. In today's episode, she very honestly and openly shares how deep into the darkness she went after Connor's death. I hope you'll settle in and listen as she shares her heart with us today. Hi, Nan. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Hi, Jill. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. So let's get started by giving you an opportunity to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself. Tell us where you're from and what life is like for you there.
Well, my husband and I live in Little Rock, Arkansas. Ron and I have been married for almost 36 years. It'll be 36 years in January. And we live in Little Rock. Little Rock brought us here due to his work, but we're both originally from Des Moines, Iowa, so we're Midwesterners. We met in junior high and actually started dating our senior year. And 2 years later, we were married. It was actually Ron who brought me to the Lord my senior year of high school. I did not grow up in a Christian home. And so that's kind of a piece to my story. But we've been in Little Rock for about 10 years. And it's been nice being here.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's not very far from Hot Springs, so we get to see you guys from time to time, which is nice. And you are a boy mom, something that I can't really relate to as a girl mom. So talk about being a boy mom. Tell us about your kids a little bit.
Well, I tell you, I wanted a girl. I wanted a girl, and God said, no, boy, boy, boy. And by the time our youngest, the third, came along, I was like, okay, God, I'm good with this. You know, I just felt at peace about it.
Sure.
And it's been a blessing. It's been so much fun. But we have three boys. Our oldest son, Brayden, is 27, and he's married. It'll be a year in February.
Yeah.
And then Connor is our forever 12-year-old. He mm-hmm. should be 25.
Yeah.
Our stair-step boys. And our youngest son, Brennan, is 23. And so Brayden is a music composer, and he is married and living in Austin, Texas, about to move to the L.A. area.
Oh, wow.
So that will be
that's
an adventure
far.
For our family.
Yes.
Yes, it is. But it is his dream. And so, you know, we're very supportive.
Sure.
And then Brennan is finishing up. He's got one more class to go. But he actually has a job before graduation, which is such a blessing. And he is 23, living at home. The pandemic brought him home from college. And
sure.
so he just finished mm-hmm. up being a virtual student. And but he's got a job, and he's chomping at the bit to get that piece of paper.
Oh,
so
sure.
We're just so excited for him.
Yeah, he's yeah. ready to launch, it sounds like.
Almost, yes. I mean, we were empty nest, and then he flew back in. And so Ron and I are actually ready for the empty nest season. So,
Sure. So tell us a little bit more about Connor in particular. Help us get to know him a little bit.
He was our middle. I don't know, our boys were stair steps. He was our middle son. But our oldest two were both very right brain, artistic mm-hmm. guys. They both loved music and movies and creativity. And Connor actually really lived in a fiction fantasy world. He was very talented as far as music, singing, performing, although an introvert. And so, I had to coax him. Yes, I had to coax him. He had a beautiful voice. I always had to coax him into singing for like Christmas productions and things like that, because he did not want the limelight and he did not want to be on stage. Although once he was out there, his gift just, shined.
Yeah.
But he was always creating, storyboarding, drawing. He wanted to be the next George Lucas. He was a Star Wars Lego fanatic. He and Brayden wanted to do the music and Connor wanted to do the movies, and they were going to do like Deal Brothers Productions. You know, they were very creative kids. At the time, right before Connor passed away, he was reading fiction stories to Ron and I at night. Like, he would read a chapter a night. And he'd get done with a chapter and say, I just want to read one more chapter, you know, one more chapter. And so I'd give in and say, okay, one more chapter, Connor.
Oh, sure.
He just loved everything creative that way. And our youngest son is the athlete, but all three of them at the time, right before Connor went home, it was a sweet season because they were 14, 12, and 10. So really we hadn't hit the angst of teenagerhood yet.
Right.
And at night you would hear them in the hallways hugging each other and saying, good night, brother, I love you. Good night, brother, I love you. And then on Fridays they'd have bunk-in parties to where they, you know, each of them had a bedroom, but one Friday night it would be they'd sleep in Braden's room. One night they'd sleep in Connor's, and one night they'd sleep in Brennan's room. And they actually really preferred being at home with one another. Connor had a hard time sharing his brothers with other people. And he had a hard time sharing me at church. He and I love to harmonize. I'm an alto. Mm-hmm. He was that beautiful tenor, and he would sit on my right at church, and we would sing together. And the boys would get so mad at him because he'd say, no, I'm sitting next to Mom. And they'd say, well, you sat next to her last week, you know, because Ron would always like to sit on my left. Connor was always on my right. But yeah, he was a stinker that way. But now I treasure those memories, you know?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
He was cantankerous as far as sharing. And he could be a little hard to get along because if he had it in his mind, it was a certain way, it was going to be that way. And yet he loved his friends. He loved the Lord. He gave his life to the Lord when he was 8. He loved his brothers. He loved his mom and dad and family. And he loved home. And he actually told me, he said, I am going to make movies. And I'm going to take my family with me. I want a wife. I want 6 kids. And, you know, I just want all of that. You know, he shared a lot of his dreams and hopes with me on the last vacation that we went to the Grand Canyon. And, you know, we had a sweet, special relationship, and I treasure it. I mean, I love all my boys. I have a great relationship with all of them, but he and I just had a little sweet little understanding, you know, and he was always in my corner. At the time, right before he passed away, I was in a play in a community theater in Amarillo when we were living there at the time. And he'd run lines with me, and the show ran like 8 times, and he was at every show. And after every time I performed, he just was my biggest fan. He'd say, Mom, you were amazing. You did such a great job. And, you know, he was my biggest cheerleader.
Sure.
Wow. And I miss that.
Sure.
I miss that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like you all had a very special relationship.
Yeah, we did. And he did with his brothers too. And with friends. And he's a sweet boy. Sweet, sweet boy. And it was a sweet time for our family. It was just a sweet time for our family. He actually had one scripture highlighted in his Bible that I want to share today. And it was Proverbs 3:5-6. It was the only verse that was highlighted in his Bible. And that's, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your path. And wow, little did I know how much I was going to need that scripture.
Yeah. Yeah. So in February of 2009, Connor became ill. So talk about what was happening. What went on there?
Well, he got a headache. He had a headache one night, and Ron and I were out on a date, and we came home and gave him some Tylenol. And he went to bed, and then the next morning he had a little bit of a hard time breathing. He was coughing a little bit. So Ron went on to church with the boys, and I took Connor to an urgent care. Mm-hmm. And the doctor just said it was more of like croup. And he said it was kind of confusing that a 12-year-old was having croup. But he gave him a breathing treatment and sent us home and said, if he doesn't feel better in a couple of days, why don't you come back and see us or go to your primary care physician. And mm-hmm. so in a day, he woke up 24 hours later woke up. And the night before this happened, he just said, "Mom, I'm not feeling great." And he had gone to the shower to take a couple of showers to break up that creepy cough.
Sure.
And, but he was never running a fever at this time, you know, so he was just a creepy cough, no fever. And I remember that night him saying, "I just want to sleep beside your bed." And I had one of those chaise lounge chairs in my bedroom. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I just like to sleep in here and be next to you." And I said, "That'd be fine." And so that morning about 5, I heard his little voice just say, "Mom, Mom." And I went over to him and he was burning up. And mm-hmm. we took his temperature right away and it was 104, almost 105.
Wow.
He could hardly stand. Ron mm-hmm. had to carry him to the car and we raced to our doctor's office. And our doctor did several tests, checked post-op oxygen levels and things like that and said, "We're going straight to the hospital." So we headed to the regular hospital in Amarillo, where we were living at the time. And they said he had, they took an x-ray and he had pneumonia in one lung. Mm-hmm. And so before we knew it, they were x-raying a lung and they were trying to give him a breathing treatment. And a few hours after we had just gotten to the hospital in Amarillo, he had this episode where he was having a hard time breathing and his eyes were looking off into the distance and he was kind of scrambling to grasp and grab whatever he could because he was having a hard time breathing. And then at that point they intubated him and put him into a coma. And that was the last time we talked to him. Mm-hmm. So it was x-ray after x-ray was, the left lung was filling up with pneumonia. Then the right was starting, found out he had flu on top of all of this that was going on. They had already started multiple antibiotics, for things like MRSA. We were praying for a bed to open up at Children's Hospital. They felt like we needed to get him to a Children's Hospital and a bed did open up. And he and I flew to Dallas Children's Hospital where they put him on ECMO. Mm. And it was amazing when they were taking him off the bed to get onto the gurney to the ambulance and the amount of time it took them to do that and for us to fly to Dallas. Ron and the boys drove all the way from Amarillo to Dallas, which is a 5-hour flight. And it took them 5 hours to, you know, they unhook something and then he'd get into stress and then unhook mm-hmm. something else and he'd go into stress and they'd take him out of that hospital bed and put him on that gurney and he was in distress. But the whole time I was thinking, a bed is opened up. This is what we've been praying. He's going to a children's hospital. He's 12. He's not a baby or an older person. You know, older right. people and babies die of pneumonia. This is, mm-hmm. we're getting him the help he needs. Bed is opened up. We've been praying for this. And then they get him onto the plane. And I remember the little tech, she was so tiny, about 4'8", and just, I mean, probably 90 pounds, dripping wet. She looked at me and grabbed me by the shoulders and said, "Mrs. Steele, do you understand the severity of this flight?" And I remember looking at her going, "No, we live in America."
Right.
And I just couldn't go there, Jill. In my mind, yeah. I never heard, "Your son is going to die, or he might die. He might not make this little flight that we're going to take." And mm-hmm. I remember as he was put on the plane, I had headphones on and I could hear everything they were doing. And they kept saying things like, "He is fragile. His lungs are this," you know. They asked the pilot asked them, "How far up can I go?" And they're like, "Oh, don't go over 10,000 feet. This little guy, he won't be able to handle it." And I remember just watching him on that gurney as they had it strapped down so his head wouldn't move. And I'm sitting, and it was a prop plane, you know, like this cold plane.
Yeah.
And looking at him. And the only thing I could think of is, "Connor, we're going to Dallas Children's Hospital and you're going to be well."
Right.
And I remember I started journaling a few days in, you know, we're about 8 days in now, a few days in thinking, "I need to tell you what's happening to you because all these people have come to pray over you. All these people have come to visit. You've lost days and you're not awake. And so I got to let you know after however long, I've got to tell you what's been happening." Yeah. I just never could go there in my mind that he would never wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand the severity of what was going on, but anyway, we make it to Dallas Children's Hospital. As I pull in the ambulance, Ron and the boys drive in, and it's like we met all at the same time. And wow. We go into Dallas Children's Hospital, and they put him on ECMO, and that is the first thing surgically that they did on him that I could not be a part of. Every single procedure that they did on him, whether it was they put in a central line or they did an x-ray or any kind of thing, breathing treatment or prone to supine or whatever they did to him, I was talking to him in his ear and telling him everything that was going on, because sure. The nurses assured me, you know, he can hear you. He can, he knows what's going on. And I wanted him to know I was there. I'd never leave him. And I hadn't left him and that I was going to walk him through everything. Mm-hmm. And then it was a couple of days before he passed that they said he's responding to this ECMO treatment. And the ECMO was, they put a hose in his neck and put him up on top of mattresses. And they were, you know, it was like a lung bypass machine. And he was up on 5 mattresses. The ECMO machine is as big as my kitchen. Huh. And it was kind of loud and noisy. And but they assured us that that was going to help those lungs that had the pneumonia in them.
Right.
Little did we know that he had MRSA on top of that. And so he is responding to the ECMO treatment and probably all of the antibiotics that he had had in his system. But they were going to pull him out of the coma. And so they started to pull him out, and Ron would play some music of him singing, and he would start to cry. I would talk to him, excuse me, and he would grasp my hand and grasp at his blanket that he was holding, and just the tears would flow because he could hear us. And I just kept telling him, I'm here. I haven't left you. We're at the hospital. And then the doctors told us that they needed to put him back under a little bit because he was in distress, and it was just, he needed to rest.
Sure.
And so we are 10 days in to this ordeal, and we were told that ECMO would be about 6 weeks. So we had gotten a place at the Ronald McDonald House, and we were going to hunker down for 6 weeks and live there. The boys had tutors, and they were going to be taught there, and we were just going to live there and ride this storm out with him.
Right.
And this 10th day in, they looked at me and said, okay, Mom, you've not left, you've not eaten, and you've not showered. And so we are worried about you. We need you to just go get something to eat and take a break. And he needs a little rest from you because I had been talking to him as they were bringing him out of his coma. And so, and I fought that. And I was like, no, I'm not leaving my son. And they said, no, we think it would be best for him. You need just a little bit of a break. And so we had some friends that were there from Arkansas visiting us. And so we decided to go get a little bit of lunch. And it took about 30 minutes. And when we came back, he was gone. The mattresses were gone. And I went screaming down the hallway saying, where is he? Where is he? And they came out and they said, Mrs. Young, we need you to go to this consult room. And I said, no, what's going on with my son and where is he and what's going on? And they said, well, we had to take him for a CAT scan. And I said, no, that's not scheduled for another 2 days. And they said, well, we saw something and we needed to have a CAT scan done. And so they put us in this consult room, which I hate those things, you know.
Oh, me too.
And as soon as they came in, I knew what they were going to say. And so I ran out and I said, I don't want to hear what you're about to tell me. And Ron said, what do you mean? Tell us what? And he stayed, and I ran in and I hopped into bed with Connor and just laid next to him and started talking to him. And Ron had the horrible job of having to go tell our other two boys that Connor was bleeding in the brain. And the MRSA had taken over his entire body, had ravaged everything, and that he was going to pass away. So Ron went and told the boys, and by that time, my parents are there, my sister-in-law's there, friends and family are there. And we had about 2 hours with him. Mm-hmm. Ron was on one side with his hand on his heart,
I was on another side, just singing to him, talking to him. Brayden was in one ear, telling him not to be afraid. Mm-hmm. Brennan was frantic around the room, trying to get the doctors to help his brother, because at the time he was 10 and he just didn't understand what was going on.
Right.
And when it got close, we just sang him home. And it was February 17th of 2009. Mm-hmm. He was 12.
Yeah. It's a very sacred moment to be there with your child when they enter heaven.
It is. And, you know, now that I'm on this journey the same amount of time as you,
yeah,
I can look back now and say I'm so grateful that I was there. Mm-hmm. I know you and I both have met many parents who were not there.
Right.
And as hard as it was, I consider that a grace.
Yes.
And a gift. So, the MRSA ravaged his body. There was not an organ to be harvested, not even his eyes to be given away. Mm-hmm. And we still to this day have no idea where it came from and how it entered him.
Yeah, when we talk about being there when our child goes home, it brings to mind something that Johnny Erickson taught, a phrase that she uses, and that is a bruising of a blessing. I do believe it was a blessing to be there for us with Hannah and for you with Connor, but oh, so hard at the same time.
It is. It is. And I, even in that part, after he was gone, I could not leave the room. I could not leave him, and I could not leave the room. And I remember at one moment, I had gone from the top of his head to the tips of his toes and touched and kissed every inch of him. And I just couldn't leave. And I remember looking over to the threshold of the doorway, and there was Ron and Brayden and Brennan standing there. Ron had his hand outstretched to me saying, "It's time to go."
Yeah.
And I remember turning and looking at Connor laying there in that adult diaper, you know, laying there on that table. And I thought, I didn't know what to choose here. Yeah. I do not know what to choose. And I literally felt like I was being torn in two. Mm-hmm. And then Ron just took my hand and walked me to the hotel that someone had bought for us that night before we flew home to do all the other stuff in Amarillo.
Yeah.
But yes, on this side of it now, I'm thankful for that bruising.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You mentioned when you were kind of introducing yourself a little bit ago that you did not grow up in a Christian home, and that Ron led you to the Lord when you were a senior in high school, right?
Yes, so, senior in high school, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So you had been walking with the Lord for many years before Connor went to heaven. But as we both know, when something like that happens, it has a profound impact on our faith journey. So how did Connor's homegoing impact your journey with God?
Well, let me go back to that verse, you know, that verse of trusting in the Lord with all your heart and leaning not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledging God. He will make your path straight. I loved the Lord, and I loved the Lord. And I really was growing up with my boys as we were teaching them about God.
Sure.
You know, there wasn't a faith based in my home. And so, you know, I feel like when Ron and I were raising the boys, I was really getting a lot of an education then too. And, you know, it was a wonderful time for me and wonderful time for my family. But in that hard, hard moment, that a seed of doubt was planted. And also
just because I dealt with some abandonment issues and some hard pains in my childhood and in other areas of my life, here was then another area of my life where, oh no, I'm feeling abandoned by God.
Yeah.
And I will say, I did not trust in him in those moments when it was so hard and so painful. Because as you know, grief can just be so all-consuming. And at the beginning, mm-hmm. when you are in so much pain that you can't even understand the pain, my crying out to God wasn't for his help. My crying out to God was, why me?
Yeah.
And I was crying in doubt, and I was crying in anger, and I was crying in just angst. And all of that then turned to bitterness and resentment. Mm-hmm. And so I started out just asking why all the time and crying out to him and saying, help me. I need you to help me. This, you know, of course, it doesn't feel good. And it's, you know, I struggled a lot with the feelings of it all and the pain, the intense pain. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't drawing near to God. I have another scripture here that I truly, you know, in James 4:6-8, it says, but he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. I started to become very prideful in my doubt and my fear and my pain. Mm-hmm. Because it was like, okay, God, I know how this should have gone down. I know how my life should have gone down. I know how this should have happened. And so therefore, we had a caring bridge and you said no. We had 30,000 people praying and you said no. Mm-hmm. So I took offense to that. And in my pride, I opposed him. And I didn't want to draw near to a God that was going to abandon me like that.
Right.
Because I knew that feeling from childhood and from circumstances and just in my life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when your anger and your resentment and that grows to bitterness, wells up, you don't have a whole lot of tools. Right. And I'll say this also. I think the enemy comes to kill and steal and destroy. And I believe in this season of my grief, this was his entering in. And it says in John 10:10, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the fullest. Well, I didn't want a life without Connor.
Right.
And I didn't want that life.
Yes.
And so everything that I thought was true about God, the enemy was whispering, well, he's not good anymore, is he? You know, so the truth that I believed about God, the enemy turned on its end, mm-hmm. and said, you know, he's not good. You can't trust him. He's not faithful. He's left you. It says he'll never leave you or forsake you. Well, don't you feel that right now? And I truly did. I mean, Jill, mm-hmm. I would go to the cemetery and just dig my hands into the ground. And I would, you know, ball up my hands and fists and just cry out to God in anger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also at that time, some very dear friends and well-meaning friends had, and I had struggled with depression. So I was already on depression medication. It was just a part of my life. My dad was always mm-hmm. depressed. And so I had been on depression medication for a while, but had some friends that well-meaning thought they'd leave some alcohol after Connor's funeral and just said, you know, if you need this just to help you get to sleep, maybe to get through the hard. And so sure. that was a start to the numbing of my pain. And mm-hmm. I will say at the beginning, it was the depression medication and, you know, a glass each night. I did right. take some sleep medication for a couple of years and then got mm-hmm. off of that. And then really my anxiety kind of came out of me and surfaced in ways that was really physically painful. And so I was on some anxiety medication for a while, but all of those with alcohol don't play well together. And right. so it became a toxic mess and also became my coping. Mm-hmm. And I'll be totally honest with you. It became my coping for over 11 years. And, yeah. you know, once you start to cope and then you rise that threshold, you only have to go even further. And so it just, to me, kept getting further and further and further into what I would call an addiction.
Yeah.
As I am walking down this road of a bad way of coping and numbing my pain, on the other hand, I am still going to church. I'm building a legacy for my son. And yet I'm still white knuckling it to God and doubting him and being angry with him. And so here's this coping skill over here. And yet I'm really still trying to trust in you and believe in you, but I'm so angry with you that I just got to have a handout to you because I don't trust you. I want to, but I don't. And so there was bad coping of numbing. And then mm-hmm. there was this, I really don't want to trust you. And I really don't want to believe what your songs are saying or your scriptures are saying, because they're very painful. So I'm going to keep you at bay. Mm-hmm. Although I was going still, but you know, I'd be in church and I hear a song and think, well, that's not how it is for me. That's not right. how I feel. You uh-huh. know, you're a good, good father. It's who you are. It's who you are. Well, if you were good, then I would have my son. Mm-hmm. It was just a very confusing time. And, at the beginning, Ron and I grieved together, and then we both kind of took a different path. I was still doubting. The pride welled up in me, anger, the doubt, the bitterness, the resentment, which really had me entangled. And he took a path of, I'm going to trust God, even though this is hard. I'm going to trust God, even though my heart hurts. I'm going to trust God, even though this is not how I want our life to be.
Right.
And so then there was that to, oh, great. I feel alone now in my grief.
Yeah.
At home.
Yeah. So at that time, if people saw you at church and worshiping and singing the songs and all the things, could they even tell what was going on behind the mask?
No. Yeah. I hid it from everyone. I hid it from my mm-hmm. family. I think another tool of the enemy is isolation. And yes. so I isolated in my pain. Mm-hmm. My knee-jerk reaction and my doubting was going on in my head. Although there were times when people wouldn't say people don't say encouraging things, or they just don't know what to say to us. Right. And there were uh-huh. times when there were things that I just would say that were not kind, uh-huh. And that was another thing. I got really prideful in my grief because it was like I was the only one that was suffering. You have no idea what suffering is. I kind of carried that mantle too of mm-hmm. I feel so abandoned by God. I did mm-hmm. not deserve this. And mm-hmm. you all don't know anything about suffering. So I would not want to hear from anybody unless they were a parent who had lost a child.
Right. Yeah, I think there are a lot of bereaved parents who feel that way. And I can remember feeling that way too sometimes.
Sure. So I had my radar up, my hands out, not only to God, but any kind of light, any kind of goodness coming in. It just was too painful. And I mm-hmm. still, even when we had built Connor's legacy and we mm-hmm. would go, I would stand in front of this beautiful building for these children and go, I don't want this.
Yes.
This is so confusing.
Yes.
People would say, Connor would love this. And this is bringing the beauty out of the ashes. And I would say, but I am neck deep still in the ashes. I don't want to be in these ashes.
Right.
And it was just trust issues. It was trust issues. And mm-hmm. I think the thing that kept me from completely going all the way away from God was that I was still going to church and still trying to pray, although right. it was ugly, mm-hmm. you know? It's really hard to explain, but I believe that once the enemy had a foothold, he also then took residency in yeah. my heart, because mm-hmm. the darkness was just dark, and that my truth and his truth were not the real truth mm-hmm. of who mm-hmm. God was and what God was trying to do in my life. And, you know, I would say, "Where are you?" And I believe he was saying, "I'm right here."
Yeah.
And I was just so prickly and so angry and so resentful that I didn't want to see that he was loving me through this.
Right, right. It sounds exhausting. As you talk about it, it just sounds like it must have taken so much energy to kind of keep all of those plates spinning that you had and all of those emotions. And it just sounds exhausting. I'm sure it was.
It was exhausting. And, you know, I was still trying to be a great mom to my boys.
Sure.
Brayden and Brennan, because, you know, that is one thing I did hear from Connor. "Mom, you are a great mom to me. Still be a great mom to Brayden and Brennan." I was still trying to be a very good mom to them. I was teaching at the time.
Yeah.
Like I said, the Legacy Project was very important to me and to, mm-hmm. to us. And I wanted something in honor of Connor and his memory. And yet by day it was this, and by night it was, "I can't do it anymore. I can't keep that all up going. And so I'm just going to plummet into the closet and
right.
literally be in the closet of numbing." And, mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'll just say this: menopause hit and I'm insomnia sure. hit, and honestly, so I am trying to take things over the counter to help me sleep. And it was a bad combination. All of that does not play well together. So I've upped the ante with numbing, and I've upped the ante with over the counter mm-hmm. medication and prescription medication. So at the time before God really got a hold of me and the redemption comes, is I was waking up at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the morning. I'm not getting any sleep, any good room. Yeah. I literally am in turmoil. I am not a big person anyway. And so, mm-hmm. and I don't, when I am grieving and not feeling well, eating is out the door. So I got pretty thin. And my mind wasn't working correctly, because all of that clouds that, and it also gives you lapses in memory. I mean, I've talked to physicians since then saying, "It's a wonder you're alive."
Yeah.
And, yeah. And you know, teaching on top of that, trying to keep all of this going. And I just will say, I was a messy griever. I was an angry griever. I was an offended griever. Uh-huh. And I put anything that was of light and of truth at arm's length. And when you're in the dark that long, it gets pretty scary
yeah.
and pretty sad and pretty toxic.
Yeah.
And that's where I was at in 2020.
That concludes the first half of my conversation with Nan Deal. I hope you'll come back next week to hear how God met her on a yoga mat and rescued her from this pit of darkness in which she found herself. I know you'll be encouraged by our conversation. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to sharing the rest of our chat with you next Wednesday.